For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Donald Trump has arrived in Washington for his inauguration as America's 45th president. The ceremony takes place in less than 24 hours. Simon Marks has the latest from Washington.
The process of transition is now moving apace. Donald Trump has given up his private plane. He flew into Washington accompanied by his family on board a military aircraft. At the White House, they're taking down Obama family pictures in the West Wing and packing boxes and bags ahead of Donald Trump's arrival there after his inauguration. In less than 24 hours, he will be America's president.
Meanwhile, Trump's team says the incoming president will kill the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal within hours after being sworn in. In his first press briefing as the new White House spokesperson, Sean Spicer said Donald Trump's first week in office will focus on dismantling trade deals by executive order and immigration and tax reform. Nina Maria Potts has more.
In a warning to Democrats not to hold up any of Donald Trump's cabinet confirmation hearings, the incoming president's spokesman, Sean Spicer, said partisanship would not be tolerated. He said Donald Trump's first week in office will involve taking action on all his top priorities by executive order without any need to consult Congress. He will dismantle the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, nor will he wait to take apart the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico and Canada. Sean Spicer also rejected concerns over Donald Trump's business interests and any sort of conflict, insisting his cabinet choices are also ready and fit for government.
In his final press briefing, outgoing U.S. Defense Chief Ashton Carter said the Iraqi military is now fully in control of the eastern portion of Mosul, Iraq, after 3 months of fighting. The Islamic State seized the city of 1 million over 2 years ago, and it has become a symbol of a fight against the group. Mr. Carter confirmed the transfer of power.
Our local partners in Iraq, with our advice and assistance, managed to secure all critical areas in eastern Mosul. As they now prepare to clear the western part of Mosul, I'm confident that ISIL's days in Mosul are numbered.
Facebook is planning to build a new data center in Denmark. The new center will be only the third such facility located outside of the U.S. Our technology correspondent Rachel Silverman has the details.
Facebook says the Danish facility will be one of the most advanced, energy-efficient data centers in the world, powered exclusively by renewable energy. The new facility will be built on the outskirts of Denmark's third-largest city, Odense. Facebook says the cold climate there could help cool servers, so it may not need to rely on air conditioners. Rachel Silverman, San Francisco.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
You know that line at the beginning of the news there? Donald has arrived in D.C. and he's handed over his private plane. When you or I go to a building or walk into a building or go anywhere, you might have to hand over, I don't know, your keys, any belongings like a laptop or a mobile phone. You see what I'm getting at? We will be talking a lot about Donald Trump on air too with Jeff Berwick. Lots to come before that. It's Thursday, 19th of January, 2017. My name is Richie Allen.
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. It's the Richie Allen Show. Brought to you in association with davidicke.com. And now, live from Manchester, England, here is Richie Allen.
Yeah, somebody said to me today, it's the coolest intro music in talk radio, Richie. I said, well, I didn't make it. Dropkick Murphys shipping up to Boston. Welcome to the program. Tweet at Richie Allen Show. Email Richie at richieallen.co.uk. There's a dollar vigilante, the anarcho capitalist activist and author Jeff Berwick joins me in the second hour, looking ahead to tomorrow's inauguration, what Trump means, and I want to talk about these trade agreements that Trump is going to rip up. Jeff will have a lot to say about that in hour two. And coming up in the first hour, this is really interesting. We spoke way back in October. I say way back, it wasn't so long ago, it doesn't feel so long ago. But Dr. David Zygmunt was on with us. He returns to the program. His private, his NHS practice was shut down in Bermondsey, East London, where he had been the local doctor for over 40 years. He was closed down by the Care Quality Commission, which is the NHS body which judges the efficiency and safety of GP surgeries. You remember all of that. A lot of bureaucratic nonsense, which led to a much beloved and admired and respected GP leaving a practice where he served as that community for over 40 years. He also wrote an exceptional book. I think some of what's happened to him is down to the book he wrote, which is entitled If You Want Good Personal Healthcare, See a Vet. Industrialised Humanity, Why and How We Should Care for One Another. This is interesting stuff. David returns to the programme shortly. We're broadcasting live on Alternate Current Radio, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and on davidicke.com and the TuneIn app. Do indeed check out davidicke.com/headlines. I shouldn't say Zionist, should I? Because I don't know what these people's political views are. Maybe I'm doing them a disservice by saying Zionist. They might not be Zionists. But the anti-Semitism charities have been in touch with the Helix Theatre in Dublin again to try and scupper the event, the Worldwide Wake Up Tour talk on Saturday, this coming Saturday in 2 days' time. They haven't had any success there either. But again, this is continuing, this harassment by some of these groups. Just letting you know about that. The event goes ahead as planned. There won't be any interruption to it. David Icke, the Worldwide Wake Up Tour on Saturday. If you're going, you're going to have a fantastic day, an eye-opening day, and one you won't forget in a hurry. I think it's all very silly myself, but there you are. Now, Theresa May has told leaders at the World Economic Forum in Davos in Switzerland that the UK will be a world leader on trade. But the PM also warned that inequality blamed on globalisation was aiding the politics of division, whatever that means. Her speech to business leaders and politicians in Switzerland comes after EU leaders said that a post-Brexit trade deal with the UK would be difficult. You might remember Pierre Moscovici, the European Commissioner for Economic Affairs, said that Brexit would be bad for the UK and for the EU equally. In her speech, May said the world was enjoying an unprecedented level of wealth, but many people felt this wasn't working for them. Here's some of what Theresa May had to say today.
Businesses, large and small, are the backbone of our economies, and enterprise is the engine of our prosperity. That is why Britain is and will always be open for business, open to investment in our companies, infrastructure, universities and entrepreneurs, open to those who want to buy our goods and services, and open to talent and opportunities, from the arts to technology, finance to manufacturing. But at the same time as promoting this openness, we must heed the underlying feeling that there are some companies, particularly those with a global reach, who are playing by a different set of rules to ordinary working people. So it is essential for business to demonstrate leadership, to show that in this globalised world, everyone is playing by the same rules, and that the benefits of economic success are there for all our citizens.
She went on to say, did Theresa May, that talk of greater globalisation can make people fearful, and that for many it means their jobs outsourced and their wages undercut. It means having to sit back as they watch their communities change around them. She went on to say, in their minds, it means watching as those who prosper seem to play by a different set of rules, while for many, life remains a struggle as they get by but don't necessarily get on. These are the types of sound bites heard at every single economic forum. They are lovely sound bites. They are lovely and fluffy and cuddly sound bites. But they are empty rhetoric. Nothing will change. Because you know, and I'm sure even your friends and family who would never listen to a programme like this, they know that May and her pals at Davos are owned lock, stock and barrel by the globalists she's asking to be more sensitive to people's feelings. You know, these people own her. I'm talking about the globalists who cause trillions of dollars of damage to the environment each year, but very cleverly externalize those costs so that we end up for paying it. The globalists who spend millions and millions lobbying ministers in every country in the world so that they are not regulated effectively and pay sod all taxes. Yeah, they have to be sensitive to people's fears of globalization. More on that, and more on that economic forum with Jeff Berwick in the second hour. Jeff will have a lot to say, undoubtedly. Now, you might have been following this overnight, this Facebook RT row. Facebook basically blocked RT's account overnight. Now, this has happened. Now, I'm not in any way comparing myself to RT. RT is a massive, massive organisation. But it's happened to David Icke's Facebook page. It's happened to my Facebook page when we've opined about certain things. But anyway, overnight, they shut down RT's Facebook page. They have since restored RT's ability to post content to its own page. They have yet failed to explain, they haven't explained, Facebook, why the blackout on RT, why it lasted for 20 hours. Everything like sharing content, live streaming, posting pictures and videos, all of that suspended by Facebook. Now, RT has 4 million followers on Facebook there. Lode Van Oost is a former deputy speaker of the Belgian Parliament. He reckons this is all part of a bigger game.
It's not a coincidence that this is happening right now. I think after what happened with all the so-called dossier on Trump and the so-called Russian hacking of the elections, that the deep state, what I would call the deep state in the US, these conglomerate of businesses and intelligence agencies, politicians, who, by the way, don't force each other's hand, they think the same way, who think that now is the time to more again emphasize this so-called Russian problem that they have. And RT was in that report as one of the main agencies, so to speak, although the real matter of that report was, paper thin, if I can say it that way. Mm. So I think what is happening here is creating again another buzz around the Russian problem. And to, you know, the proverb says where there's smoke, there's fire, to give an impression to people, well, there must be something wrong with those guys. What's going on is part of a bigger plan.
It is part of a bigger plan. Now, Mike Pence, the vice president-elect, sat down with CNN yesterday and he talked about a number of things. The hacking or alleged hacking by Russia in the US election, and also the United States' future relationship with Russia and Vladimir Putin. This is a little cut of what Pence told CNN yesterday.
And our president-elect has made it very clear that he is determined to try and improve the relationship between the United States of America and Russia. That's not to ignore the evidence that we have about Russian involvement in hacking last fall, but it's just his determination to come in recognizing that we have a terrible relationship with Russia right now, and to explore the possibility of improving that relationship. But remember, it's not so much about being friends with Russia. It's about once again establishing respect between the two parties and the two nations, and looking for ways, Dana, that we can work together for common purposes, most specifically, finding ways that we might marshal the resources of both of our nations to hunt down and destroy ISIS that represents a threat.
Absolutely,
to all of our
and
people.
there are lots of ways to work together. But just to shoot a little bit on this, what I've heard from Democrats and Republicans is if we don't send a signal to Russia that this is not okay, then this is going to give a green light, not unlike the red line in Syria. This is going to give a green light to other countries. You know what? You can meddle in American elections and you're not going to get punished for it. We're going to reach out and say you're our friend. You think there's something to that?
I think the fact that this last administration, whether it was moving red lines or feigning resets with Russia, established a pattern on the world stage that eroded the respect for our country.
So how do you stop that? Can you stop that by drawing a line? I mean, you said provocations by Russia need to be met with American strength. I would imagine you would think that's the case if they meddled in American democracy.
Well, I can promise you that when his right hand comes down this coming Friday, the world will see American strength in the Oval Office.
The interviewer there is a right psychopath, isn't she? She's like one of those children at school who says to another child, that kid over there called your mother a tinker. Unbelievable. We have to show strength, right? We got to show force. Psychopath. I mean, it's, you know, we could spend time going over old ground about the creation of ISIS, who created it, color revolutions started by George Soros and others. But even if we didn't do any of that, nobody has ever asked the question, ever, in the United States, why would we be bombing terrorists thousands of miles away in other countries? Let them deal with it, surely. Of course, the stock answer is, well, they're a danger to us. It's all madness. And as for Russia, nobody has presented any evidence that Russia was behind the hacks. I think we can say with 99% certainty now, they were leaks from the Democratic National Committee. They were leaks. Doesn't matter though, the neocons and the Zionists, they want war. And they're surrounding Donald. Here's Lindsey Graham on Fox News yesterday.
President-elect Trump has said, basically, we don't want conflict with Russia until we have to, because it wouldn't serve our interests. Gotcha. You have said, and I think I'm quoting, we need to hit them hard.
Yes.
Why would that serve vital American interests?
Great question. Number one, what Russia did in our election did not change the outcome. Donald Trump's a legitimate president. Clinton lost because she was a bad candidate. Trump won because he is the agent of change. It's not because of what the Russians did, but what they tried to do is interfere in our election, and what they're doing all over the world is try to break the backbone of democracy. If you forgive Putin, your screaming weakness. Remember the red line? You better not cross this red line. If you use chemical weapons, I'm coming after you with Assad.
Yes.
Obama did nothing. If you forgive Putin for what he's done in our election and what he's doing all over the world, he will be on steroids, and it's the worst possible thing you could do to reset relationships with Russia. You need to smack him in the face. I don't want a war with Russia, but I want them to pay a price for trying to undermine our democracy and what they're doing all over the world to other democracies.
You'd love to take warmongering psychopaths like Lindsey Graham and drop them right into the middle of Raqqa, or right into the middle of, I suppose he'd have to go back in time now a few weeks, right into the middle of Aleppo, and give him a shotgun and give him a Kevlar vest and say, off you go then, you psychotic murdering maniac, you lunatic, you coward, off you go. You want war that badly? Off you go, pal. You go and do it yourself. Lunatics. It's exactly 17 and a half minutes past the hour. It's going to be fascinating tomorrow. It's going to be fascinating to listen to that inauguration speech, or I should say the inaugural speech. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens over the next few days and indeed the next 3.5 months. We will endeavour on this programme to get opinion from every angle. You know, those who continue to support Trump no matter what, they will be afforded time, of course, on the programme. But I think we know what's going to unfold, I think, whether it takes a month or 2 months or 3 months. But like I said, Jeff Berwick on the programme an hour or two. I'm going to take a back seat when Jeff is on. I get to have my say a lot on this issue. I want to hear Jeff's take. That's all coming in the second hour. Right now, though, we're going to take a break. Keep the tweets coming in at Richie Allen Show. And the email address is richie@richieallen.co.uk. I'm looking forward to hearing from you.
Do not risk putting another pound in your bank account until you've heard this message. It's Jim Rickards here, best-selling author of Currency Wars and The Death of Money. But today I'm urging you to claim a free copy of my brand new book, The Road to Ruin. Visit theroadtoruin.co.uk for full details now. Inside, I uncover the financial elite's secret ICE-9 plan to take full control of your hard-earned cash. To see how, visit theroadtoruin.co.uk right away. It's not too late to prepare. Claim your free copy at theroadtoruin.co.uk today.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbayerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Join in tonight's discussion by tweeting at Richie Allen Show now.
Yes, it's Thursday, the 19th of January 2017. You are listening to the Richie Allen Show, and we're broadcasting live, of course, on Alternate Current Radio, on Fab Radio 2, and, of course, on the TuneIn app. Now, later on, UK time, 2 a.m., that's 2 a.m. tomorrow morning, the Boiler Room programme will be live on alternatecurrentradio.com. Terrific show. Check that out. I think it's 9 p.m. Eastern time in the U.S. That's 2 a.m. here. Check out the Boiler Room on alternatecurrentradio.com. Do check that out and bookmark it. And if you can't stay up that late, the programme is immediately archived on the website. Oh, yeah. We're going to chat with Dr. David Zygmunt again. Extraordinary man. Loved hearing from him back in October. His story is really important. We'll catch up with him. I know you'll have plenty of comments for him. Kicking off the tunes is Norman Greenbaum. This is Spirit in the Sky on your Richie Allen Show in association with DavidIke.com. Past the hour, Norman Greenbaum and Spirit in the Sky on the Richie Allen Show. Let's move swiftly on so we can maximise the time with our guest in the first hour. He was on the programme last October to talk about how his practice in Bermondsey, East London, had been shut down after 40 years of exemplary care and service to his community. It was closed down by the Care Quality Commission, which is an NHS body which judges the efficiency and safety of GP surgeries. There was nothing inefficient and there was nothing unsafe in his surgery. Like I said, beloved and trusted by the community he'd served for so many years. He's also the author of If You Want Good Personal Healthcare, See a Vet. I'm delighted to welcome back to the programme to catch up on his story, Dr. David Zygmunt. David, welcome back to the programme. How are you?
Hello. Yeah, well, the short answer is short answer is pretty well. The longer answer is probably rather more interesting, because I've had to manage, I would say, successive rings of grief, really, for the loss of the occupation that I love, with all the connections that I had with people over many years, which I had valued a lot. But beyond that, I have to grieve really for what has happened more broadly to my profession and the idea of personal and committed care for people that you know over a long period of time, and that is vanishing from our health service. So I grieve for those things. And then, of course, there's the more personal grief that I deal with as best I can, which is about, you know, my aging and the fact that, of course, eventually, even if I hadn't been forced out, I would have to give up what I've spent my life loving and doing. So the short answer is well, and the longer answer is, I suppose, at least for me, more interesting. But anyway, the answer is well, thank you very much.
David, you know, when I say I've never suffered a great injustice, I had a very difficult time as a child, and I eventually worked that out. But I don't understand the sort of injustice that happened to you, and I can only guess and speculate that, you know, you go through the gamut of emotions from anger to despair, from desperately wanting to, I don't know, open a door or open a window and, you know, walk into a room and it'll all be gone and things will be back to normal. I'd never, you know, in any way try and say, well, I understand all that. Would you believe, and I'm sure you will believe, since we announced you were coming back on the programme today, and in fact running around today, it was late when I published the details of the programme, we've had loads and loads of tweets and emails from people wishing you well. And of course, question number one from people coming in was, has there been any news on the case since then? Have you continued to ask the questions that you've been asking about what happened to you? And is anybody doing anything? Have you heard from anybody?
Well, they go very quiet. If you go onto my homepage, that's David Zigmond, Z-I-G-M-O-N-D. If you go onto my homepage, there's lots of articles and letters. And I have written a letter and a long analysis of the Care Quality Commission's report. It is long, but it's readable. So if anybody's interested, they can find it. It's called The Proof of the Pudding is in the Eating. That's what it's called. And it's right down at the bottom of my article section. Anyway, in that I very politely actually analyze the report and its unfairnesses and its inaccuracies. And I also pose to them why I think that they have made these errors, and inviting them for further discussion. And they have not responded. They've just gone quiet. So from the health service itself, I get a stony or maybe a rather anxious silence. But from other people, I've had an enormous response. I've had hundreds of people contacting me, and not just from not just patients or people from the medical affected by the medical profession, but also teachers and social workers, or just people who are very concerned about the growing disconnection they feel amidst large corporations. And then I've also had people, doctors writing to me from abroad. For example, I had a Danish doctor saying, help, things are happening in Denmark that looks like it's going the same way as it's going in the UK. Can you help us? Which, of course, has a certain irony in view of the fact that how I help him, I was taken out.
But your experience, of course, is vital, and I don't want to sound like I'm patronising it. Your experience is absolutely vital in how what's happened to you. Can I ask you this? Another question I was asked to put to you, and forgive me now, we really have had dozens and dozens of questions, because sticking with this theme, can you work this into what you've just been talking about, Denmark? And you can talk as much about what your contacts have been telling you in Denmark all you want. The floor is yours. When people say, and I hear nurses, in fact, the last time I was at my local surgery was about 8 or 9 months ago. Yes. I was a lovely nurse there, very young woman, only a couple of years in the profession. And she said to me, you know, all of my colleagues, many of them have been in the job 15, 18, 20 years, they're demoralised. They're absolutely demoralised. And they can see the National Health Service going under and disappearing. What do they mean, David? Because listeners listening, what does that mean? When they say the health service and the staff are demoralised, they're at their wits' end, what are they talking about?
Okay, what has happened is that nobody is... The two things have happened, at least. They are that people don't know one another anymore, and people don't trust one another anymore. Those, I would say, are two very important themes. We don't know one another anymore because the idea of personal continuity of care and personal responsibility of care has all been chopped up and divided into lots and lots of different teams, all of which are very proceduralized. And things have happened like, for example, small general practices with a named doctor have been replaced by enormous practices staffed by part-timers where people do not have a named doctor. And you're seen by a carousel of strangers. Now, what that means is that you never get to know anybody. What governs you is not your knowledge of the patient and the relationship you have with the patient, but a whole system of rules and diktats that the computer choreographs and commands you. So there's that, and then there's also the fact that in hospitals we no longer have general physicians who might look after a number of different conditions in the same patient, usually elderly. What you now have when you go into hospital is a number of different teams, all of which is responsible for a different system or a different part of the body. So if you're aged 80 and you go into hospital and you've got a bit of diabetes and a bit of heart failure and you've got pneumonia and you've got vascular circulation insufficiency in your legs and you're a bit depressed and you're a bit forgetful, you can easily end up under 6 different specialists. Now, what all that means is that doctors don't get to know patients, patients don't get to know doctors, people just feel governed by procedures that are worked out by management and executive bodies, which then have to be supervised very, very closely.
When did this happen? Was it under Tony Blair that this came in, or was it before?
Well, okay, I wouldn't blame any particular politician, although the idea of the internal market, in other words, you divide purchasers and providers in the NHS, that came in under Margaret Thatcher, that she thought that she could apply principles of competitive manufacturing industry to welfare. That came in with Margaret Thatcher. But the Blair government and then Tony Brown, Gordon Brown afterwards, so that was, 16 or 17 years.
Yeah.
They polished it up, renamed some of the ideas, but essentially kept them the same. So there hasn't been a break with that. And, of course, since the new Labour government, we've had the Tory government, which has just continued the same agenda. But it has been made worse with the Health and Social Care Act, which a lot of people don't understand.
Give us the horrifying bullet points, David. What our American friends would call the Cliff Notes version.
Okay.
Of the Health
I'll tell you something about the Health and Social Care Act. It takes this idea of the internal market, And it amplifies it. So the idea is that you have in the health service a number of different trusts. So you have a hospital trust and you have a primary care trust. So if you go into hospital, they're looking after you. And if you go and if you're looked after in primary care, they're looking after you. And then the two trusts trade between one another. So the idea then is that the hospitals charge the primary care trust. Okay. Now, what happened with the Health and Social Care Act was that Andrew Lansley said that what he was going to do was he was going to make the GPs responsible for all for the provision of services, or the design and the provision of services for the whole of the community. So they would buy and sell hip replacements, out-of-hours services, hearing aids, pharmaceutical services, and the GPs would be responsible for coordinating that. And what it's done is it has placed an impossible and an intolerable burden on GPs, because it's very difficult to be a good family doctor. You have an enormous range of people with all kinds of problems, and you have to know everything from intricate biochemistry in the body to what can go wrong with that, and then all the way through to local charities and social resources and so on, and everything in between, and to understand people individually when they come and see you. So it's a very, very difficult job. It always was to do it well. And what they've asked GPs to do is they're saying, not only have you got to do that, not only have you got to fulfill all these rules and criteria and so on, but you're also responsible now for negotiating the best price for hearing aids for your community or artificial hips and so on. So they then have to get commissioners to and supervise the commissioners in the purchase of these things and to negotiate with hospitals about how to provide a good thyroid endocrinology service, for example. Well, it has become a grotesquely impossible job for them, although they are doing their best to make a good fist of it and not to panic.
They're swimming uphill.
Very demoralized because an enormous amount of their work now is about either having to administer things that are very, very complex and should actually be left to expert and long-term civil servants, or they themselves are having to comply with all sorts of diktats that they're getting from other authorities, as I did, and which I fought against, and which, of course, I was ruled out on because I refused just to comply.
I mean, one of the things they were asking you to do was they were asking you to spend a limited amount of time with each patient, which to, you know, a layperson like me was horrifying, because Dr. Zygmunt might have Mrs. Murphy might be, you know, somebody that would come in and say, I've got this feeling, I've got this, and you have a quick chat and she's on her way and she's happy to be on her way. But then somebody, you know, Mr. Smith might come in and he's upset and he's not well and he might be on his own and he might need an arm around his shoulder. But I've never heard anything so ludicrous. Dr. David Zygmunt is on the line, and this is why he was forced out of a community where he was much loved for over 40 years, because he wouldn't comply with this crazy, stifling bureaucracy. Dr. David, is this deliberate? I'm not putting words in your mouth now, but we feel this is deliberate because it's about getting it to the state. I mean, how many great thinkers over the years and great writers have said, if you want to privatise something, destroy it, cause an outcry, and then come in with the solution. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, I know a lot of people think that. I don't have a strong conviction that that is the case, that what they're trying to do is to destroy it and then say, see, it doesn't work. What we're going to have to do is we're going to have to sell it to a lot of American financiers or to Bupa or to Boots or something. No, I actually don't think that is the major destructive force. I think the major destructive force is that we don't understand that the best way to deliver welfare is to create the kind of environment where people both feel cared for themselves, they, the employees, the health carers or the teachers or the social workers or whatever it is, and are encouraged to do a good job by bringing their best heart to it, their best energy, yeah, and making their best judgments. And instead, what we have become suspicious of everybody, and we assume they cannot do a good job unless they are constantly being checked up on and supervised. And that is what is demoralizing, that professionals no longer feel they have autonomy and respect. I don't mean a deferential respect of doffing the hat because one is a doctor or a senior teacher or something. I'm saying the respect that, unless there is good reason to suppose otherwise, that that person's professional judgment is probably going to be competent. And of course, you have to be vigilant as to when it's not. But the idea that nobody can be trusted and everybody must be checked up on for every little action all the time, and they've got to checklist and risk factor analyze everything, is burdensome beyond viability. In other words, it creates so much effort and creates so much fatigue that it's not workable anymore. And that is the demoralization that is like a dry rot in timber. Eventually, it's going to collapse.
So
The bark can't bear the weight.
So, David, for you, it's like, you know, silly bureaucracy, jobs worth, and, you know, people acting above and beyond their station. I mean, I hear what you're saying.
Yes.
When I was a radio producer, I was a very good organizer. I'm not anymore, but I used to be a very good organizer of people. And I could imagine myself working in a hospital or working in an area where there were two or three NHS GP surgeries. And like you said, I wouldn't be deferential and prostrate myself in front of a doctor just because he or she was a doctor. Yeah. But I would have enormous respect for their experience, and I would never expect them to be justifying themselves to me as to why they did X, Y, or Z. I would think David Zygmunt's a great doctor. They love him in the community. Get out of his way. I would see myself as, how do I best facilitate you doing what you do without getting in your way? But, you know, when we see what's happening with education, with academies, when we see what's happening with the prison service here, and even when we learned that Virgin, Richard Branson's company, is getting tens of millions of pounds worth of social care contracts, I'm loath to disagree with somebody of your experience, but to me, I can't help but think compartmentalization is at work here. You know, in terms of that, great men and even some of those idiot bureaucrats probably deep down are not bad people. But I think behind it, behind the Jeremy Hunts of this world, are corporations. That's what I see wherever I look, you know.
But you see, when you talk about not trusting experience, what the Care Quality Commission didn't have the wisdom to see was the fact that here they were dealing with a practice that had never had a serious complaint needing a hearing and had never needed a coroner's probing inquiry, and had very, very high levels of satisfaction. So, and had never had an accident or a claim. I'd never contacted a defence organisation and so on. So clearly there's an awful lot that's going well here. And rather than saying, look, we understand that this is an eccentric and unusual practice now because it's very, very small and it's in an 1830 building and so on, and the place was unusually, is environmentally unusual in that it didn't look like a doctor's surgery. But clearly there were some very good things about it. And rather than saying, tell us how do you do that? How does that work? And so on. They went in just looking for anything that was irregular that didn't fit their template of must-dos. For example, I didn't have oxygen, and they thought that was terrible. And when I tried to explain to them, look, the nearest hospital is half a mile away, And they are far better at dealing with somebody who's breathless than I am. If somebody comes in here and needs oxygen and I really want to tend to them, I can't do my surgery that morning. It's going to take an awful long time. No, they shouldn't come and see me if they're very breathless. They should go to the hospital. Rather than listening to that, they say, oh, no, that is such an error. That is such a deviation away from what we require that immediately that becomes an intolerable risk. Well, I didn't agree with them. I would agree if I was 30 miles away from the nearest hospital.
Yeah.
But the fact that I'm half a mile away, no, somebody who's breathless shouldn't come and see me because they will get much better attention in hospital where they've got all the backup facilities if they're to deteriorate.
Do me a favour, David.
But they wouldn't discuss it with me.
They wouldn't discuss it with you. Do me a favour. Remind our listeners about this thing about time spent with patients, because I don't want to sound now like I'm, you know, in any way sycophantic, or I'm not trying to create drama here. But I spent about 2 days after we spoke in October walking around, and I am somebody who obsesses over things. I do obsess. And I'd be out walking the dog, and it would come back to me, and I'd get angry. They wanted you to spend an average of, what was it at the time, 10 minutes with a patient, something like that, wasn't it?
Well, I think, yes, it wasn't, that wasn't something that I said so much. What I did say, though, was that, for example, they said that there was not evidence that I was taking adequate care of my mental health patients. Why? Because I wasn't filling in their computerized depression questionnaires. So, in other words, what they were requiring me to do was, if somebody came in and said that they were very despondent and unhappy and dispirited, for example, it may be that their marriage was finishing, or that somebody in their family has a very bad illness, or they were having to cope with an unexpected redundancy, or that they, for example, couldn't get over something terrible that happened to them when they were small, or whatever it is, that they wouldn't trust me to assess how to deal with that anguish and unhappiness in a sensitive conversation where I attuned my questions and my approach to them. What they wanted me to do was to immediately present the patient with a questionnaire to assess the degree of depression, they call it, and the risk of that. And I didn't agree. I did not think it's a good way to spend that initial time with somebody who is very, very anguished and unhappy and feeling very, very vulnerable, and that I should be trusted to conduct the kind of interview that I thought best, for which, incidentally, I have had an excellent record. That people wanted to come and talk to me because they got just that kind of interview. They got a personal and sensitive interchange with me rather than something that I was scripted to deliver to the patient by the computer. And they thought that that was bad practice because I was not doing that.
There's common sense, David. If you ask anybody, what would you rather, if you were in a bit of a bad spot, a bad turn, and you went to your local GP whom you know, would you like he or she to grab out a clipboard and a paper and start asking questions? Or would you rather they sat alongside you with a cup of tea and said, what do we need to do for you today? How can we help you today? Sure. I think it's madness. Dr. David Zygmunt is on the line. His book, If You Want Good Personal Healthcare, See a Vet. With the byline, the subheading, Industrialised Humanity, Why and How We Should Care for One Another. It's outstanding, terrific reviews at online retailers. We've tweeted where you can get it, and we recommend it strongly. Before I ask you the question, which kind of follows up on the privatisation thing, if you foresee, if things continue the way they're going, if you foresee eventually where people will have to pay some sort of fee to have access for some services, before we go down that road, I've got to ask you, David, and I asked you this last time, but the book, and not only the book, but you would have been known for having a very open mind and being forward-thinking and being open to new ideas in the way you thought about medicine. Was any of that relevant to what happened to you? Were you getting in any way punished for, you know, your ideas and your embracing of alternative ways of doing things?
Well, I think the evidence is that that is the case, although the Care Quality Commission and NHS England, who are my employers, would deny that. They would say, oh, no, we had to take him out for public protection. We found out that he was a very risky practice. So it's always impossible, isn't it, to prove motivation, because motivation is something internal, and if somebody denies it, how do you prove it? It's all circumstantial. However, I'm pretty sure that if I had not made my views known publicly, but always, I believe, courteously, if vigorously, if I had not done that, I don't think they would have gone for me like they did. But I accept that that's unprovable, because the other side can just deny it and say, oh, no, we were having to stick to the rules. But I don't believe that, really, because I don't believe people do have to, that authorities do have to stick to the rules like that. For example, the police don't prosecute everybody who drives along a motorway at more than 70 miles an hour, although by law, that is what they should be doing. Nor do they arrest everybody who is drunk on the street. No, they don't. And they decide when to apply those laws and when to have the wisdom not to. But we have entered a stage in the NHS where we think that all rules have to apply to everybody equally all the time. And I think that it shows a lack of wisdom, because wisdom is about flexibility. Wisdom isn't about always doing things. Wisdom, in my view, is knowing when not to do things. So, for example, the care quality, I talked to you a minute ago about the oxygen.
Yes.
Sometimes it would be very important that a doctor should have oxygen on their premises, if they're a country doctor, for example, and they provide out-of-hours services as well. But it shouldn't apply for a doctor who is close to a hospital in a city and who is not providing those out-of-hours emergency services. Equally, they documented the fact that I didn't do regular fire drills with checklists against the fire drills, and then meetings about how all the checklist things were done, and then follow up meetings to make sure that the corrected checklist things were identified and actioned and so on. And I explained to them that my practice is a tiny practice. There's four rooms in it, and the reception, everybody who comes in sees the receptionist. So we know exactly who's in the building, and there aren't very many of them at any time. And there's one long straight corridor with a front door at the front and a clearly marked fire exit at the back. And if there were to be a fire, you just shout, fire, this is not a drill, everybody out, and all six people, however many there'd be in the surgery, would go to the nearest exit, which would be the one away from the fire, I would suggest. And that is a completely different situation, is it not, too? For example, one of those great big health centres that has got not just GPs in it, but health visitors and chiropodists and child
like the one I go to,
so on. And it might have 50 consulting rooms with all these people working in it. Nobody knows who's in the building, because they have an automated greeting service where people tap in a password or their surname or their date of birth and so on. So the receptionists don't know who's in the building, because they don't receive people anymore. Only the computer knows who's in the building. Yes, and all these 50 consulting rooms are on three floors with five corridors. Now, I can see the need then. There really is a need with a health centre like that for fire drills, yeah, but not in my place. But they again wouldn't accept it. And they thought that, or that at least they said they thought, that my not doing fire drills was posing a terrible risk to the public.
Which, of course, it wasn't. You're obviously, from speaking to you twice and from reading, we've tweeted your site, by the way, macro-learningsystems.com. We'll tweet it again. You're obviously a principled man. I'm guessing that there's a massive hole in the community that you've left behind you. And I guess your patients and your neighbours are devastated by what's happened. The obvious question is, and I might have posed it last time, maybe I didn't want to pose it last time, given, despite the absolute insanity of what's happened, given the chance to do it again, knowing what you know now, would you have appeased them and gone along with them, or is it that important that you stand up to it now, that you'd change what you did?
Well, you know, I've asked myself this question many times, and I'm still uncertain about it, although on balance, I think I did the right thing. Now, I think I did the right thing in terms of my integrity and probably my health. So as somebody said to me, they said, David, you've left with your health and your integrity intact. The problem is your legs have been blown away. Yeah. Now, had I continued, I would. There's no doubt that NHS England wanted me out because I'd been a public critic, a senior public critic of the way we're going. And I think there are all kinds of follies in the system. And they don't like small practices anyway. And because I was a vocal and dissenting small practice who made my dissent very public, I think they thought, well, he's old enough and small enough that if we hit him hard in the face, he'll reel backwards and won't be able to get up again. And indeed, that is the case. That because of my age, I'm now 70, even if I'd appealed, I couldn't pay my receptionist all that time. My lease was coming to an end. It would be economically impossible to start myself up again. Now, if I had continued and kept my head down, never contradicted them, and been very obsequious to the Care Quality Commission investigators, I could have said, oh, I'm terribly sorry about the oxygen. Of course, this is an oversight, and I do apologise, and it'll be dealt with right away. I do assure you that we'll always be, you know, and if I'd been apologetic and deferential and so on, who knows, I might have got through. But I would have had to spend more and more of my time having to submit to draconian regulation, which is exhausting and frustrating, and I would have felt resentful that I wasn't spending all my time in having to box tick these ever greater compliance issues, and I would have less and less time for the work that I love, which is about imaginative care of individual patients. I would have had less and less time and energy for that. And at the age of 70, I think that I probably would have got ill because of the frustration and the resentment. So it's probably saved my health. Yes, but I miss my work enormously. I will never get a job like that again. I loved it from a human point of view, an intellectual point of view. I loved it socially, that I had people to say hello to in the morning, who I built up bonds of affection and understanding with, and who I could off and off of things that would help them get by. I was interested in their human stories. I loved that my staff had such good morale and wanted to come into work, and we did a lot of serious, sometimes very sad things together, and we also laughed a lot, you know. And it was like a second family for me, and I was very privileged to have had that for as long as I did, and I'm grateful for that. So my answer's quite complicated.
It is, but yeah. It's difficult for me to listen to that. I'm not going to go down that road because we've only got a couple of minutes left.
Yes.
I want to ask you, you said that you don't think there are malevolent forces driving it into the ground in order to bring about privatisation. And I, I respect that. You've worked in it, you know more than I do. My opinion, I still lean towards it is being destroyed to prepare the way for privatisation. But accepting that, you're right, and it's not malevolent. However, regardless of whether it is or whether it isn't, continuing upon its present course, it's going to end up that way anyway, isn't it?
I think so. But you see, I think that you're partly right in that I think that there are possibly some on the right who would say, oh, no, this is hopeless. What we've got to do is to get people to realize that this would fit in with the authority. Get people to realize that they're going to have to be responsible for their own health. They're going to have to make provision for it. And we're going to have some kind of networks or private insurance companies. But be aware that the Blair and Brown government, who were there for 17 years, things got worse under them too, that there was more and more and more regulation under Tony Blair. Yes, it's got worse with this government since the Health and Social Care Act, but it was much worse in the early noughties as well. I mean, not worse than now, but worse than it had been before that. And I don't think that New Labour was trying to privatise, trying to dismantle the NHS, but they bought into the myth that if you have an internal market, it will drive up standards. It will incentivize to work better if people feel that they've got to be competitive, if people feel they've got to do things for a lower price and so on. And I don't think that is what motivates doctors. No good doctor that I know works better because he thinks he's working for a competitive organization or he's got to compete with the next practice. They do a good job because they grow to care about the people that they tend. And they can only grow to care about those people if they get to know them. And because we now have a system which is geared against getting to know anybody, that's more and more difficult.
I want to thank you for coming back. The book is If You Want Good Personal Healthcare, See a Vet. All good online retailers. We've also tweeted David's website. I said this back in October and I mean it. Consider the programme an open door to you, David. When there are issues concerning healthcare, and you've got a lot of forward thinking, I hate to use the word progressive because it's got such dire political connotations, but at the same time, you do have great ideas and you're embracing, and you were embracing, continue to embrace different ways of thinking about people's health. Anytime you'd like to come back on for a chat, sincerely, drop us a line and you're welcome back. Thank you so much for your time. I mean that.
Well, and thank you for being so receptive and interested, Richie. I appreciate that also.
You're a gent. And our producer, Claire, loves you and loves what you've been doing. We're thrilled to have you on the programme. Come back anytime. Dr. David Zygmunt on the line to us there. Terrific. Again, the website, macro-learningsystems.com. That's macro-learningsystems.com. The writings, the blogs are on there. And links to where you can get his book as well. You have to conclude. And there are those listening to programmes like this now. Well, you always jump on the conspiracy bandwagon. Listen, his criticisms of the health service and his criticisms in his book of this bureaucratic, stifling nonsense had to have played a part in them asking him to do fire drills in that tiny building, in asking him to fill out those forms, in telling him you've got to spend only so much time with patients. You've got to conclude that. It's exactly 2 minutes past the hour. We're past the first hour of the programme. This is the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2, alternatecurrentradio.com and the TuneIn app. Coming up later on alternatecurrentradio.com, The Boiler Room with Hesh and with Spore and with guests, presumably, and Hesh can give me the yay or the nay, presumably talking a lot about the inauguration tomorrow, which I'm going to talk about with Jeff Berwick, the dollar vigilante, shortly on the programme. For the moment, though, we're going to pause briefly.
Do not risk putting another pound in your bank account until you've heard this message. It's Jim Rickards here, best-selling author of Currency Wars and The Death of Money. But today I'm urging you to claim a free copy of my brand new book, The Road to Ruin. Visit theroadtoruin.co.uk for full details now. Inside, I uncover the financial elite's secret ICE-9 plan to take full control of your hard-earned cash. To see how, visit theroadtoruin.co.uk right away. It's not too late to prepare. Claim your free copy at theroadtoruin.co.uk today.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Welcome back. Loads of tweets. Hi to Gail. Hi to Faisal, who said it's great to hear from Dr. Zygmunt again. I do hope he turns things around enough for him to be reinstated, says Faisal. I hope so as well, Faisal. La Antenna says the power of computerized statistical analysis went to the heads of the socially lobotomized box tickers, systems people. Hi to Justin as well. Hi to JP, by the way. In Manchester, so many field mouse tweeted at @lone_horse. I heard an American say he thought private healthcare was being run down so as to bring in a state system, ironically. Thanks, field mouse, for that. I'm sure there are Americans who think that. I'm not sure that I agree with them as well. Hi to Hubertes as well. To Linda Berry. How you doing, Linda? To David Cole. And let me scroll down there to Richard Mace. Now, Richard said the obsession is to do things right rather than doing the right thing. Richard said the obsession is to do things right rather than doing the right thing. That's a very good way of putting it there, no doubt about it. Again, if you want to see what other people are tweeting, you just go to Twitter, put Richie Allen Show into the box, press enter. Wired Wrong on Twitter says, loving Dr. David Zygmunt. Brilliant to hear from him. Thank you so much for those lovely thoughts. Lawful Rebel. Is it Bren Buckley? I've been noticing lately, pets do get the best treatment. Apple cider vinegar. MSM, not mainstream media. Super Vet. You've been watching the Super Vet. Who's a guy called Noel, as far as I remember, Irish vet, who's very famous for coming up with inventions and doing operations on animals. I can't remember his surname. Noel. It is Noel. I'm sure you'll tell me on Twitter. Irishman, considered to be the top man in his field. Hi to Luga as well, and to Gary Dugan and to Trey. So many people tweeting the programme. I love this. I haven't been able to get on the emails. Again, that's a problem that's ongoing. And until the website is done up, as we say in Ireland, until we do the website up, email might be a problem. So probably the best thing then is to continue to tweet me. Mumford and Sons had a song, or have a song, had a song, have a song called Lover of the Light. I love it. When we come back from it, Jeff Berwick will be with me.
And in the middle of the night, I may watch you go. There'll be no value in the strength of walls that I've grown. There'll be no comfort in the shade of the shadow's throne. But I'd be yours if you'd be mine. Stretch out my life and pick the seams out. take what you like, but close my ears and eyes, watch me stumble over and over. I had done wrong, you built your tower, but call me home, and I will build a throne, and wash my eyes out never again. But love the one you hold, and I'll be your goal, to have and to hold.
Mumford & Sons, Lover of the Light on the Richie Allen Show in association with DavidIke.com. Hesher tells me reliably they will be talking about the inauguration on the Boiler Room at 2 a.m. tomorrow morning, GMT. Check out alternatecurrentradio.com. Brilliant stuff. The tweets keep pouring in. Lots of good wishes for Dr. David Zygmunt. However, let's move on and welcome back to the programme our next guest. He is a terrific guy. Love having him on. It's been a while since he was on. I want to mention straight up that he's the organiser and the host of Anarca Pulco. That's Anarca Pulco, which takes place in Acapulco, Mexico, between February 25th and 28th. It is the world's first and certainly the biggest anarcho-capitalist conference, February 25th to 28th. And you just have to go to anarchapulco.com. Don't worry about the spelling. I'm going to tweet it now. That's anarchapulco.com. He's a libertarian. He's a broadcaster. He's an author. By the way, check out Shemitah Trends, a second edition, The Plot to Enslave Humanity and How to Find Freedom. That book available at all good online retailers. Let's welcome back to the programme our old friend Jeff Berwick. Jeff, you're very welcome. How are you?
Good, Richie. How are you doing?
I'm very well. And thanks for not putting the camera on. Last time we spoke, I think it might have been in the spring, miserable here, and you had the camera on. I could see the waves. I could see the palm trees. And it pissed me right off for about a week, Jeff. So thanks for not doing that. It's great to chat with you, mate. I guess you're really busy right now.
Oh, yeah. Always busy, but extra busy, as you mentioned, the conference coming up in about a month here in Acapulco. We actually have more than one conference. We have an Acapulco, and then the Dollar Vigilante has its own one-day summit. Of course, everything going on with Trump. I've been busy ever since Trump got selected back in November. It's just been a whirlwind of things going on that we need to cover.
Brilliant. Now, G. Edward Griffin, Jeffrey Tucker, Adam Kokesh, your good self, Larkin Rose, Luke Radowski, Lauren Southern, Julia Turianski. I could go on. The great Max Egan, of course. You've got an absolutely terrific lineup of speakers there. Anarchapulco.com. Check it out, folks. Jeff, we heard today our news bulletin, which we broadcast at the top of every hour. They said the Donald is planning on, very early on, in fact, in the small hours maybe even of Saturday morning, the day after, the night before, when he is Mr. President, ripping up the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. Do you believe this? And why is this a good thing?
Well, I really don't know what to believe with Trump. That's why it's going to be so interesting in the coming days, because he's said so many things, and a lot of the things he's said has been conflicting. So we're going to find out what he's really going to do fairly soon now, so that's good. I've said about Trump that he gives off more mixed signals than a quarterback with Tourette's. He's like the first Twitter-based president, and he's just tweeting at all hours of the day and night, all kinds of crazy stuff. You don't know what's, you know, he could actually start wars on Twitter now, which kind of, you know, scary to some extent. But we'll really see what's going to happen now. I know he's talked about being against those so-called free trade deals. Of course, they're not free trade deals. A true free trade deal would be one sentence long. It would say the people in these two countries are allowed to trade freely without any taxes or regulations or tariffs. But obviously these so-called free trade deals are literally phone books that you're not even allowed to see. So these are obviously massive corporate scams. He has talked out against them. So we'll see what he does. Hopefully he does get rid of them. It looks like he is. And if he does, that's great. And, you know, I'll support him on anything he does to move towards more freedom. And we'll see what happens.
Absolutely right. The Twitter war thing that you cracked a joke about there, it's hilarious. But it's serious too, isn't it? I mean, we've never seen anything like it. I've been covering news and current affairs for a long time. And, you know, I've always said, and I did promise Jeff today, because we've already had tweets from people saying it's great fun when Richie and Jeff get together. But listen, I'm not going to be jumping in talking about free market capitalism. I'm not going to do that today, because I get to have my say all the time, and I've got to be more aware of that. And I don't want to go down that road anyway. But Jeff, you're right. You know, I don't think anything is black and white. I think the House always wins in politics anyway. Ultimately, I believe that. But this guy... Maybe this guy, I don't believe maybe he's the real deal, but maybe he won't be as easy to control as maybe previous, you know, stooges and puppets have been. And maybe that Twitter craziness that we see is some indication that he might hold certain truths very, you know, he might be very sincere about certain things, and that some little bit of good might come out of this guy. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's possible. But I'm sort of with you in that I believe that all this stuff is mostly all scripted. He's selected. I actually said that Trump would win because I started to recognize that the elites had chosen him to be selected. He was actually speaking at a major Jesuit function with Hillary Clinton just days before the election. So they had already brought him into the club. The Jesuits are one of the most nefarious organizations for controlling things behind the scenes. You know, they do all sorts of things. They, you know, that's a big part of this whole democracy sort of scam in the beginning, is you have these 4 or 8 year periods and they'll do so many crazy things. And of course, we had Nobel Peace Prize winner Barack Obama, who had 8 years straight without one day of peace, drone bombing country after country, dropping thousands of bombs every year. And so I think they just push it as far as they can, to the point where when someone else comes along, everyone's just so relieved. They're like, okay, this guy's got to be somewhat better. And it never is. And they'll always say all kinds of things, all kinds of platitudes. Like even when Barack Obama came in, he said he was going to stop all the wars. He was going to shut down Guantanamo Bay. He obviously did none of that. He's exactly the same as Bush. Everything that Trump has said that he really he hasn't said he wants to change anything really important. He hasn't said he wants to actually shut down the Federal Reserve. He said maybe they'll audit it, but really there's no point in auditing it. We know exactly what it does. It's a scam. It needs just to be shut down. I doubt he'll ever do that. If he does that, and that's the other thing, if he does sort of try to do some real things, he'll probably get JFK'd. So this is going to be very interesting to see what happens.
You know, Paul Craig Roberts, the former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, who pops on, who pops into the program fairly regularly, agrees with you wholeheartedly, Jeff. He agrees with that, that if there was any real authenticity to the guy about these big issues, he wouldn't be long for the world. So what about this? And listen, I was being kind of, you know, devil's advocate earlier on. I got it wrong. I believed that the elites had chosen Hillary. I didn't see the light as you did right up until the event, right up until the day I was saying, look, I believe it's, you know, a foregone conclusion. But I've begun to think that I fell for something maybe I should have seen through, and that he was always the chosen one. So I agree with that. Now, on what Paul Craig Roberts is saying, this whole CIA row, Jeff, we're supposed to believe at the moment that there is a major, unprecedented, never-before-seen standoff between the president-elect, who will be the president this time tomorrow, and the CIA over hacking, which we believe was leaking by DNC staffers. We don't believe the Russians did it. Not that they're angels, but we don't believe they did it. So is this a contrived bit of theatre again, Jeff, this alleged standoff between the intelligence agencies and Trump? Are we being played for fools?
Yeah, it's really tricky to see and to tell what's really going on. For the most part, everything is staged when it comes to that level of the U.S. government and politics. People in the U.S. need to recognize they're all slaves. Slavery did not end 200 years ago. They just made everyone slaves now, and that's exactly the case. So Trump doesn't want to shut down the Federal Reserve. He definitely doesn't talk about shutting down the IRS. And so those are the only important things that you need to shut down if you want to free the people. So as far as the CIA thing goes, it is very interesting. There might be a bit of an infighting going on. There might be a bit of a control play going on between people that are with Trump and the more the real globalist types. It is possible that Trump is trying to move away from the globalists somewhat. I doubt it, but it's possible. And if it is possible, and if it is happening, there's going to be some very interesting things happening. We even saw one of those senators was on the mainstream media, or fake news, as I call it, in the U.S., and basically warning Trump that if he went against the CIA, they have six different ways from Sunday to get him. So, you know, there's threats being thrown out there right in public about these sort of things. I think the only thing that we can do at this point is just watch and see what happens. There definitely could be some sort of control play going on. There might be some players trying to play around, but I don't think any of it is really of any benefit to the people as a whole. This is just a power play for who gets to control the people, not for who actually wants to free the people. But I hope I'm wrong. I hope Trump is the savior. I hope he is going to try to shut down the federal government as much as possible, to shut down most of these unbelievable agencies, to get rid of all the corruption, all of the graft, all of the everything to do with the government, get rid of it all. But I doubt it. He said he was going to drain the swamp, but it looks like he's been mostly refilling it with just the same old sort of people. He's got some new faces in there, but there's a lot of Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, all the same sort of people, all the same scumbags. We'll see what happens. It's going to be interesting.
It's going to be very interesting. I can understand men and women in cities where manufacturing has disappeared. Intelligent men and women, but not women and men with qualifications, so they depend on manufacturing. When they hear him say things like, we'll make it more difficult for people to buy cars from overseas, and I'm going to kickstart the motor industry, I can understand why there is unbridled joy. And today, Jeff, one of Sky News's most prominent anchors is a guy called Adam Bolton, is in the States, and he's covering the inauguration. And he was in the heartland, Jeff, you know, and he was meeting people that depend on skilled or low skilled or semi-skilled jobs. And they really believe him, and they're really excited, Jeff. And my heart, I'm not a soppy guy. I'm not a guy who gets emotional very easily. But my heart was kind of breaking for them, because they've believed this, you know, right? Loads and loads of new automobile factories are going to open, and they're not, Jeff, are they? It's not going to happen.
Well, it actually could happen to an extent, but it won't actually be of any great benefit to most people. It'll be a benefit to a few people who work in those factories, but all of these protectionist policies actually destroy the economy. That's actually one of the reasons the U.S. was quite very, very wealthy for a long period of time and quite free, was because they didn't have all these sort of things. So the people in the U.S. had the ability to take all of the best things from the rest of the world and get the cheapest and the best products because they weren't being actually taxed and tariffed and all these sort of things. When you do that, you actually really more and more destroy the economy. So, you have a lot of these people who are sort of more poorer or lower middle class, those sort of people, and they're complaining a lot about how they can't afford anything anymore. And so they want the minimum wage to go up. Well, the minimum wage, the reason that they can't afford anything anymore is because the central bank is printing so much money that is causing the price of everything to rise, and the wages can't keep up with that. So they need to go after the Federal Reserve, go after the central banking system. But instead, a lot of them fall for the same old government stuff. Oh, the government will help by shutting it down or making it cost more. So all Trump's really doing or saying here is he's going to make things much more expensive to buy in the U.S. That's all he's saying by saying that, because he's saying, oh, well, if someone wants to bring in cars, it's going to cost 30% more. Well, cars are now going to cost 30% more in the U.S. How is that going to work out for a lot of people? So these things are not actual real great solutions. They're sort of populist measures that some people think is going to help them. But as usual, the thing that they think is going to help them is actually going to hurt them.
It is, yeah. And if this might be surprising you now. Not that we didn't agree on a lot before, but we argued quite a bit about things. But I see exactly where you're coming from there. And when these people were speaking to camera in the Vox Pops today, they weren't considering the fact that these factories would be heavily automated anyway, wouldn't they, Jeff? I mean, they just would be. And, you know, you're not guaranteed to get 10, 15,000 people into a big plant. They would automate those. But on the protectionist stuff, I see both sides of that argument. I can understand why people who, you know, at the base level say, well, why can't we make things in our country? Why do we import things that we might be able to make here and create jobs? Now, I know that sounds very simplistic, and I know it's not simplistic. There are, you know, things are more complicated than that. But, you know, years ago, Jeff, and I've said this a few times on the program, this guaranteed Irish label we used to have on Irish goods, it was like a symbol in the form of a G, but it wasn't an obvious G, but it was a label, a trademark, guaranteed Irish. And back in the day, you know, in the recession in the late 70s, we were encouraged, I was only a child then, you know, buy things that are Irish. It would ultimately help stimulate things in Ireland. What's wrong with that at its base level, buying American?
Well, there's nothing technically wrong if you want to personally buy things that are made by people in your area, but by actually enforcing through violence, which is government, that people have to buy certain things in certain areas. And if other people try to trade, you're actually just screwing up the free market system. And the free market system, when allowed to operate, is the best system for the greater good of all people. So it keeps the prices low by doing that. But once you start to slow it down or stop it or stop the movement of labor even, which is another thing that government does, all you do is increase prices and things like that and just make it harder and harder. So a lot of these people who want jobs, for example, actually no one should ever really want a job. We should want that we have so much wealth that we don't need a job. And the way to do that is through the free market. But because we've had so much government and central banks now for like a century, this Federal Reserve has been around since 1913, it literally makes almost everyone have to just keep running and running and running just to pay the bills. So what people really need to do is wake up and realize that it's the central banks and it's the government with all their taxes and regulations and bureaucracy that is actually impoverishing everyone, and try to get rid of those things. And then we'll have so much more prosperity, no one would even believe it.
Jeff Berwick is on the line, folks. Go to anarchapulco.com, the conference between February 25th and 28th in the wonderful Acapulco in Mexico, which I've never been to. I was in Central America before, but never Mexico. Amazing lineup of speakers there over the 4 days. Wonderful world-class resort and some really, really exciting thinkers going to be speaking there. Anarchapulco.com. Jeff Berwick is on the line. Of course, that's where, you know, you just hit the nail on the head, Jeff. When central banks are loaning money into existence and not creating the interest, we're condemned to forever be in this debt cycle that increases and increases and increases. The free movement of labour, some of our listeners will undoubtedly want me to take you up on that. They will say, right, okay, I understand where Jeff is coming from. But if you look at the European problems at the moment, we have unfettered migration moving into Europe because of the manufactured crises in Syria and elsewhere. And that just drives down wages. You know, it certainly puts a big... Now, again, I'm putting listeners' points of view. I have some sympathy with these. Others, you know, I disagree. I agree, and I change my mind as much as I change my underwear. But on this one, I understand that when you allow unfettered immigration and you allow people coming from economies where, or countries where, you know, the economies are not competing, they're not earning as well, they come into a country like the European, like the United Kingdom, and they drive down wages, Jeff. That's what that does, doesn't it? It drives wages down.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you really can't have the free movement of labor if you're going to have these big governments that have all these social security safety nets and things like that, because that's exactly what happens, as you pointed out. That's why you have to get rid of all those things. Those things cause way more problems than they ever solve. So you just get rid of all those things and go to a free market. If we had a truly free market in the entire world, you wouldn't see massive amounts of people just moving on a whim. Most people really just kind of like living where they live. Most people I know, even Canadians or Americans, they just stay in Canada their whole life or stay in the U.S. their whole life. They just like being around where they grew up. And those are the same with people in Syria and the same with people in Libya. The problem is that people in Libya and Syria are under the massive terrorist attacks by the North Atlantic Terrorist Organization, NATO, and the U.S. Department of Offense. And they are literally having to run and flee from those areas because of those massive attacks. And it's actually all been done on purpose. You can actually look into it.
Absolutely.
They actually put most of these refugees into Turkey and held them until about September of last year. And then they just unleashed them into the European Union to cause chaos. This is all on purpose, all to destabilize things, all to make it so people ask the government for more, to do more things, to lock down more freedom, get rid of more freedom because of all these refugees that are all of a sudden flowing in for no apparent reason at all. It was actually all planned. So yeah, these things get really messy, and it's really kind of difficult for a lot of people to understand what's going on. Even myself, I don't know everything that's going on, but I know a lot of it. But if we could get to a real free market system, the actual free movement of capital and free movement of labor would not be an issue at all. It's just in this really warped, horrible central banking, big socialist sort of government, big government sort of systems that it causes a lot of problems.
Yeah, it's you could say, as David says, a communist, fascist dictatorship. That's what, well, I can speak obviously from experience of the European Union. I've got to bring up, and by the way, it's 29 minutes to the top of the hour. Jeff's going to stay with us for another 15, 20 minutes. Loads of comments. I will get to them shortly. Loads of tweets there. Jeff, you'd have been, I'm guessing you'd have been surprised, maybe not surprised, but maybe happy with the decision that the voters of the United Kingdom made when they decided to leave the, what I would call again, the fascist dictatorship of the European Union. How have you read that, Jeff? What happened there? And what do you make of all the wrangling at the moment in terms of all of this? Because the government would deny this, but there's definitely a big stalling going on while they try and figure a way out of actually honouring what the people have chosen, which is to leave the European Union. It looks on the one hand like they're desperate to get out and leave the single market and all of that nonsense. But really, I know better than that. I know that they're working their way towards maybe late next year or 2019, another referendum. How have you read all of that? What have you made of it?
Yeah, I was quite surprised when Brexit won. I was expecting Brexit to not win because they usually rig these elections completely. I believe Scotland, the Scotland referendum was totally rigged. Many of the other sort of secessionist movements were rigged in the past. So I was expecting Brexit to be rigged as well. This is something interesting, and this is something related to Trump as well. And this is why I started to realize why they might let Trump in, is the elites are actually starting to lose a lot of control. Their mainstream media propaganda channels, their fake news, is really just no one's watching it anymore and no one believes it anymore. I think it has less than 10% of people in the U.S. actually think it's honest, real information on the mainstream media anymore. So they're losing a lot of control. And because thanks to the internet and thanks to shows like yours and many other people putting out real information out there, they're losing control. So I think if they rigged once again Brexit, and if they rigged Trump, because there was a lot of – I never met one person who actually liked or wanted to vote for Hillary Clinton. So yeah. If she won and if Brexit lost, then I think a lot of people would be like, okay, this is all rigged, and then they might actually go out into the streets and do something. So I think what they decided was, okay, let's let them win. And so with Brexit, they're like, let them win. But then we just really won't do anything. So Brexit, as you pointed out, that one, what was it, more than 6 months ago now, or was it last year? I don't even remember.
No, you're right. It was June 23rd, 2016, so we're approaching 7 months, and They haven't triggered Article 50. In fact, there's a Supreme Court decision pending next Tuesday morning, which will decide whether or not they have to get parliamentary approval before triggering Article 50. I mean, this is tyrannical. The parliament themselves voted to have the referendum. So the MPs voted to have the referendum, and they said that it would be binding, and that leaving the European Union meant leaving the single market. Now, we have a situation where private citizens, although very dodgy people indeed, were able to challenge this decision at the Supreme Court late last year and say, well, she can't now just trigger Article 50. She must get parliamentary approval. It's a nonsense. But we're going to find out probably on Tuesday morning that she does have to get parliamentary approval. And she even said herself, Jeff, Theresa May the other day, that any deal that she comes to, or any agreement she comes to with the European Union, that in itself later on would have to get parliamentary approval. It ain't going to happen, Jeff.
Yeah, that's my impression, is that it's probably not going to happen. They'll just keep going over this for years and years until people just sort of give up caring about it and then just keep moving on. They might actually sort of break up the European Union to some extent. That actually is possible, but it'll be under their terms, under the elite's terms. It won't be under anything that anyone votes for or anything like that. They just might switch up how they do things. But yeah, that's my impression with Brexit, is that they probably weren't going to move forward with it very much. And it's the same with Trump. I think, you know, this is the same thing that we have with every new president that comes in. There's always this little bit of hope that they're going to be different, right? And I brought that up earlier. And I remember when Barack Obama came in, there was so many people just thought the world, you know, was saved. The savior had come. And what happened? Absolutely nothing. In fact, he ramped up the war effort. And what happened? Because he was sort of this nice-talking Democrat, all of a sudden the anti-war Democrats or anti-war left just disappeared for the last 8 years. So he just went on bombing just as much or more than George W. Bush, and no one cared anymore. And so I think with Trump coming in, a lot of the people who were kind of against all these things that Obama was doing, like Obamacare and all that sort of stuff, Trump probably won't change much. He actually has already said that. He's already backed off most of the things he said he was going to do. He said he was going to get rid of Obamacare. He's totally backed off on that now. He said he was going to put up a wall on the Mexican border and make Mexico pay for it. And now he's like, maybe it'll be a fence parts. He said he's going to put Hillary Clinton in jail as soon as he got elected. Oh, they're nice people. You know, he's been friends with them for decades. So, you know, I think it's just putting in a new face, sort of like Brexit. Let the people think they won so they get back to work and paying their taxes and not trying to change anything, and let them think they won. But I don't think anything really big is going to change with either one of them.
24 minutes at the top of the hour, anarchapulco.com. Jeff Berwick, check him out. Also, our friend, of course, is known as the Dollar Vigilante. He's on the line to us, and we're talking about the inauguration of Donald Trump, Brexit, what's really going on with these things. Loads of tweets came in. I'm going to read just a few of them quickly, and then we'll move on. Huberto says that in the late 70s, he was told he had a job for life at Ellesmere Port car factories. Within 5 years, most people were sacked and replaced by robots. Martin tweets, there is no free market, it's a stitch up. Banks lend money as it doesn't exist, credit and charge interest on it, fraudulent. There is no free market, Martin says. Presumably, like Jeff, he would like to see a genuine free market. Loads of interest in this as well. Faisal says, centralised corruption affects the real economy much more than the free market against or versus protectionism policies there. It's at Richie Allen Show, richie@richieallen.co.uk. Jeff Berwick stays with us. You see, Jeff, do you think, you and I agree on what Trump is and who put him there, but do you think that something good that might come out of this is many of these people who as you said, have now begun to see through the, you know, the corporate media owned by the tiny amount of massive corporations, because they've seen through that. When Trump becomes, when it becomes apparent to them that Trump is screwing them just as bad as the previous guy, do you think rather than just get disenfranchised and sick and tired, that they actually won't, Jeff, that they'll actually begin to do something? Do you think this might be the tipping point? When this guy lets them down, you know, I'm always saying this because I'm like you, I don't believe in any of them. I've never voted for any of them, even here, even in Ireland. When this guy becomes what they believed he wasn't, rather than just disappear and go away quietly, people might take, I don't mean take up arms now, but they might start to make themselves known and their voices heard. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think thanks to the internet, that people are waking up. So I think after 2008, 2012 with Ron Paul, there was a lot of people really behind Ron Paul. Ron Paul was sort of the more libertarian, almost anarchist sort of guys who wanted to shut down pretty much everything the federal government did. He was had a massive support. He was truly run out of the election. He would have easily won. He was filling stadiums as big as Trump, or actually way bigger than Trump. So people woke up after that. And then, of course, now we've had what's happened with Hillary Clinton actually totally just railroading Bernie Sanders, totally just rigged the DNC election and actually got totally caught doing it and then said it was the Russians who caught her doing it. So then it's okay. It's yeah. Weird now. Now we have to bomb Russia. So a lot of people saw that. So you have a lot of people on the left now who were sort of Bernie Sanders supporters. They were sort of like the Ron Paul supporters of 2008, 2012, saying this whole system is just a scam. It's all rigged. We're going to see a totally different style president come in for the first time really ever. There's really never been anyone like Trump before. And I'm sure he's going to do tons of crazy, horrible things. That's just what governments do, and that will wake people up as well. And you're already seeing a huge backlash from all these sort of leftists that don't want them. And they're actually talking about seceding. California, for example, wants to secede. Not as an anarchist, I'm always like, if at first you don't secede, try again. I want to see as many things secede as possible until we get to 7 billion governments on Earth. And so, yeah, there's a ton going on. This is actually fascinating and amazing time to be alive to see all this happening. We're seeing all the old power structures all collapsing. And it's really what happens now and what we end up replacing them with. And hopefully it's really nothing. Hopefully it's just the free market. If we end up replacing all these old power systems, the central banks, the big governments, with true free market, we'll have peace and prosperity on Earth like we've never known it. The other way that it could go, though, especially if they're going to try to cause World War III over it all, which they're already talking about and positioning for, is it could go to complete tyranny. So we're really at a crossroads for humanity in the next few years. There's a ton of reason to be optimistic, and that's why coming to a thing like Anarchapoco is really uplifting. You can see all the people creating all these new systems for the free market so that we can get rid of the old systems. But if we don't go that way, we could end up in complete absolute tyranny in the coming years with everything, NSA, everything being spied upon, everything being taxed, all of us being rammed into the taxation and banking system, which is bankrupt, with negative interest rates, all of us being impoverished, complete police state watching over us. It could be just terrible. It
would be terrible. Bail-ins, of course. Kevin Randolph. Kevin is in the US. If Trump doesn't follow through with most of his promises, the people that voted for him will have his arse, says Kevin Randolph. Now, Mark Atwood tweets me to ask, what does Jeff think about white dragons / new control over the financial system? Are the cabal being removed?
You know, I know what this person's saying about white dragons, but I've never looked into it too much. It seems really like fantasy, like fiction novel sort of stuff. And I've never seen any evidence of it. But I think there is, like I just said, I think the globalists are losing control right now. That's why John Kerry said a few years ago, he said, this little thing called the internet is making it really hard to govern. And it is. And they're losing control. People are starting to wake up. The thing that people don't understand yet is what the solution is. So a lot of those people, or some of your listeners, Richie, they're like, well, we have to keep people out so we keep our jobs and all this sort of stuff. They don't understand that free market economics will actually improve everyone's lives dramatically. So they don't understand the solution. And so a lot of them are, well, let's vote for Trump. Maybe he'll fix it. So they're thinking the government, you know, just by reelecting someone else will fix the system. But
Stockholm
it won't.
Syndrome. It's Stockholm Syndrome. Let me ask you, because there will be listeners and they'll have expected me and you now to be, you know, going toe to toe. But let me just ask you this, right? And I will not get in your way. Explain to our, because you know what I've said in the past before. I say, look, I know you're sincere. I know you're very bright, and I know you mean what you mean. As I said already, sincerity. But if with all these free trade deals, like as you said, genuinely free trade deals, right? Without all that corruption and all that nonsense, explain to our listeners who might be saying, well, what would happen then is our, you know, companies within our countries would go outside of the country to buy what they need for the cheapest they can get it. And ultimately, that's going to have an impact on people in their own country. This is, you know, I know it's a time-honoured and probably a boring argument for you at this stage, Jeff, but give them the simple answer as to why they wouldn't have to worry about that.
Well, that's actually already happening. That's pretty much why you can buy an iPad for $100. All those parts come from Asia. It's all actually put together in Asia. So it's already all happening. So I don't know what this person's really worried about. It's already all happening. The only thing is that under a free market system, there wouldn't be any taxes and regulations on top of it. So it'd be even cheaper. So it'd be much better. As far as, you know, the jobs, this is a thing that people have to get their heads their mindset thing. This is, you know, when they go to your government schools, your public indoctrination camps for 12 years, they never teach you to become an entrepreneur. And the reason is because they want you to be an employee, because then they got you in the tax system and then they can just drain you for the rest of your life. And that's what makes you actually poor. You actually, most people wouldn't really need a full-time job if we didn't have big government and central banks. There'd be so much prosperity and wealth, but most of that's siphoned off. So people just are unaware that they've already been just completely impoverished and completely destroyed by the government and central banks. If we just remove that boot off of their neck, they won't even want a job, and everything would be so cheap, but everything would be like free to live pretty much, because there'd be everything would be so much cheaper without taxes and regulation and all these tariffs. So people just need to get their heads out of that. Like the person who tweeted in, I was promised a job for life, and then they replace me with robots. It's like, why would you ever want a job for life? That sounds like the worst thing that could ever happen to anybody. It's like, you got it all wrong. Like, we should just get rid of the governments and central banks, and then you just wouldn't have to work very much. If you want to work, go ahead, but you really wouldn't have to, because everything would be so cheap and so much. You just really wouldn't have much expenses. Your houses, you wouldn't have to pay property tax anymore because there'd be no government. If you did make money, you wouldn't have to pay any income tax. No government. Your actual money wouldn't actually go down in value every year, because there'd be no central bank inflating at 5 to 10% a year, impoverishing you. You'd pretty much be pretty rich compared to how you are today if we just remove those things. But most people don't realize it, because they go to their government indoctrination camps for 12 years. Then they go home and turn on their mainstream media fake news, and they tell them that the problem is we need the government to fix this and more government to fix that. We just need to get rid of the government and the central banks, and we'll all be fine.
Well, you know, listen, again, I see your point. I also see the point of the listener, because, and when I say I see your point, because you're right, the indoctrination camps, the schooling that we had. Look, we were told that you had to go to school, you had to finish it, and the purpose of that was to get a good job. We were all told that growing up, Jeff. You know, we all had mothers and fathers saying, got to get a good job now, get a good steady job. And you know, we all had that image of getting a job and being in a factory or being somewhere, and because our fathers did it, our grandfathers, they got the gold watch after 30 years. It was definitely ingrained in our thinking. Now, Lone Horse on Twitter says, Jeff, I don't understand how you can have capitalism without the state to protect the wealth of the rich. Now, I know you'll probably say you've answered that already, but if you want to just address that, how you can have capitalism without the state being there to protect the wealth of the rich, what do you say?
I don't know how the state protects the wealth of the rich right now. It mostly just takes their money. It takes 50% of their money every year from the wealthy. So I don't know why this person thinks the government needs to protect the wealth of the rich. And the other thing to point out is, in a free market system, you wouldn't have these massively, massively wealthy people. It'd be much more... Everyone would be much more closer together in terms of income. This is all created through the government system, through the incorporation system, which is also a part of government. It has nothing to do with free markets. Corporations are nothing to do with free markets. They're a contraption of the government and actually offers them protections. So maybe that's what this person is talking about, the protections that are afforded to corporations. But
well, governments, sorry to jump in, Jeff. Governments do privatize state assets and do sell them to private companies, don't they? It's one of the things they do.
Yeah, but I don't think that relates to the question.
No, maybe not. No, but it's something to bear in mind. I mean, central banks, of course, you and I have spoken about this. I think we agree. We've spoken about this before. Central banks, through organizations like the European Union, loaned money to governments to bent and corrupt and filthy politicians, knowing those loans could never be repaid, to ultimately have a massive free-for-all grab, which we've seen now in Ireland, Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, for all their real wealth in those countries, which should belong to every man, woman and child in those countries, the water, the transport, the rail, the roads, all that sort of stuff. So maybe that's what he's getting at. That's one way that governments do protect the super rich. They basically sell them everything that's of any worth, maybe. What do you say?
Maybe, but I don't think the rails, the roads and all that should be owned by every person either, every person who lives in a certain geographical region. But I'm just confused about the question because I don't see how, for example, if there was no government tomorrow, how would someone like Bill Gates lose all his money all of a sudden? I don't understand. This person, I don't understand the question. I don't think it's...
Yeah, I see where he's coming from. He's basically... and you and I've had this, we've had this out before, we're running out of time anyway, we've not got long to go. But yeah, that basically, without the protection of governments, of politicians, the super wealthy in society wouldn't be able to do what they do effectively, is what he's saying. And you know,
oh,
from
yeah.
previous
no, I agree with that.
I have a lot of sympathy with that. Well, it's going to be fascinating, Jeff, isn't it? The next 100 days, the next 6 months, because even though you and I agree and we know what's going to happen with this guy, I absolutely endorse what you said about this guy being off the reservation. I think they chose him because of his narcissism, because of his massively egotistical personality, and it could be very funny along the way, you know, and I don't want to be in any way, you know, insulting or disrespectful of people who might suffer under, you know, these people and what these people do, but from the outside looking in, I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating. Give us a quick plug again for Anarchapulco, Jeff.
Sure, yeah, I just mentioned that, yeah, it's going to be a fun few months and years ahead, seeing what Trump does for sure. It's going to be entertaining, and that's the best way to look at politics. People want to check out the Dollar Vigilante, dollarvigilante.com. We're also on YouTube. Just plug in Dollar Vigilante. And we also have our Dollar Vigilante Summit at the end of February 24th. And then February 25th to 28th is Anarchapulco. It's the world's largest voluntarist gathering. As you mentioned, Richie, people like Max Egan and so many great people. Just freedom, people who just love freedom and want to see freedom brought into the world more and more so we have more peace and prosperity.
These discussions are vital, Jeff, because we're talking, I mean, I'm talking to a learned man whom I agree with a lot and on some areas I don't agree with. We all want the same thing, Jeff. And that's the beauty of programs like this and of conferences like yours and what you're doing. We all want the same thing. Whether we disagree over the details, it's really not that important because we want the removal of these criminals, these globalists, these central bankers. As a very start, at the very beginning, that's what we want. Fascinating again chatting with you. Really loved it. And I'll be in touch real soon, Jeff. Have a great conference in February. And as always, stay in touch with us.
Thank you, Richie.
Look after yourself. Jeff Berwick on the line to us there from Mexico. Check out anarchapulco.com. That's the conference, February 25th through February 28th. It'll be fascinating. Fascinating guy, interesting guy. Loads of tweets, but I've got to take a very quick break. I better take that break. Back in a minute with some more of your tweets and tell you a little bit about what's going on with the television show. Because I did say, and I wasn't lying when I said it, that we would start it this week. We're going to start it next week. I'll tell you more about that in a minute.
Do not risk putting another pound in your bank account until you've heard this message. It's Jim Rickards here, best-selling author of Currency Wars and The Death of Money. But today I'm urging you to claim a free copy of my brand new book, The Road to Ruin. Visit theroadtoruin.co.uk for full details now. Inside, I uncover the financial elite's secret ICE-9 plan to take full control of your hard-earned cash. To see how, visit theroadtoruin.co.uk right away. It's not too late to prepare. Claim your free copy at theroadtoruin.co.uk today.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Welcome back to the program. It's exactly 6.5 minutes to the top of the hour, Thursday, 19th of January, 2016. Do me a favor, if you haven't done it before, and I know many of you have done it before, do check out the Boiler Room program. Now, alternatecurrentradio.com got some terrific programs in the schedule, Sunday Wire being one of them. They've always promoted and supported Catherine Albrecht, who wasn't well last year. Wonderful woman. She was on programs with me going back to Spain some years ago. Pippa King, another wonderful woman whom I bumped into with Joe Lomax on Saturday last. Pippa really into RFID tagging, of course, and chipping. So they've got great programs. It's not the... it's only been around Alternate Current Radio. I think it's been less than 2 years. Maybe I'll be corrected. Check out the Boiler Room live at 2 a.m. a little bit later on, 2 a.m. Thursday morning UK time. The programme is on 9 p.m. Eastern time, Thursday night in New York Eastern time. You know all of that anyway. So good stuff. So the television show then, we're working on the player. The webmaster at davidicke.com is sorting out a player so that the radio show will carry on as normal, so that on Thursday there's not much hassle. It just becomes a TV player. So we're working on that. We're hoping that we will begin the television show next Thursday. I think we will do. It'll be live at around about 9 p.m. on Thursday nights, right? From BVTV Studios in Manchester, Cheetham Hill, Manchester. Now, if it doesn't happen next week, and I'm pretty sure it will, we'll have a radio show as normal. That's all I can say about that. I will be on the radio live on Sunday morning, this coming Sunday morning at 11 a.m. GMT with Sunday View. Sunday View is definitely going ahead this weekend. We missed last Sunday only because I was having lunch with none other than the old man. He's not my old man. I call him the old man affectionately. David, because he was in Manchester. Obviously, we had a bit of lunch and I didn't do Sunday View. I had a bit of a lie-in. We had visitors, you see. We had visitors. So, yeah, Sunday View, Sunday morning. And I'm a bit croaky as well. It's been a long old week. Long week this week for some reason. I've enjoyed every programme this week. The programmes have been great. The guests have been brilliant. But the days, I've been knackered all day long. Knackered today as well. Difficult sometimes, you know. You think it'll never come. 8 o'clock will never come. And we can get on the air and do what we like doing, which is having a chat with you. Long old days. I'm feeling it this week. I'm really feeling tired. I really am. But anyway, not during the programme, but leading up to it is exhausting. Right, so that's it then. Stay with our broadcast partners, ACR, Fab Radio 2, davidicke.com. Stay with davidicke.com/headlines. If you're going to be in Dublin at the Helix Theatre, and my producer, Claire Calvey, is going to be there. If you bump into Claire, say hello to her. She's been a great help to this programme since she came on board, helping me produce it every day. She's taking her daughter to see David. If you bump into Claire, say hello to her. And you're going to have an amazing day. If you're going to it and you've never seen it before, it's going to be jaw-dropping at times. It's going to be emotional at times, and at times you're going to be incredulous, and at times you're going to be clapping, and it's amazing. It's a wonderful thing. I can't recommend it highly enough. And to find out where the Worldwide Wake Up Tour is going in 2017, just go to theworldwidewakeup.com and find out more there. Have yourselves a wonderful weekend. I haven't said this for a while, but I'm going to say it now. Uncle Richie, disconnect. Apart from those going to see David, of course, disconnect. Get away from it. Get away from Facebook. Get away from Twitter. Get away with arguments or from arguments with people about Trump and about everything else. Get away. Get out in the countryside. Go for a walk. Trust me. At weekends, I have no interest. People can't understand it. They can't believe it. Some people think it's wrong. You're wrong. You shouldn't do that, Richie. You know, you're supposed to be there 24/7. You know, analysing these things, researching, getting guests on. No, no. My day and a half with my tiny family is my day and a half. Get away from it. I don't care. The world could be coming to an end. And it works for me. I recommend it for you. Look after yourselves and one another. Have a fantastic weekend. Thanks to all the very, very small crew of the Richie Allen Radio Show. I'll see you on Sunday at 11. Bye for now. Have a good one.
We have all the time in the world. Time enough for life to unfold all the precious things love has in store.